From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. First guest this morning is David Quammen. He's the author of 2012's book Spillover that predicted in detail the 2019 COVID pandemic. The past 2 years, David has been hard at work interviewing 94 virologists and infectious disease experts about the SARS-CoV-2 virus, its origins, evolution, and its journey through the human population. We look forward to having David Quammen back on the program.
Our second guest this morning is Nicole Junger Halpern, who has written a book called Quantum Steampunk. How's that for a title? It's the physics of yesterday's tomorrow. Halpern re-envisions the steam engine and the laws of thermodynamics from the 1880s Industrial Revolution through the lens of today's quantum information revolution.
These two guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our next guest is David Quammen. He's the author of 2012's book Spillover that predicted in uncanny detail the 2019 COVID pandemic. Quammen's opening paragraph, written in 2012, told us what scientists believe could be coming. 7 years later, it came. Since its emergence in 2019, 6 million human souls have been lost around the world. David Quammen, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, John. Hi, Lynn. It's good to be back with you.
It is great to have you back, David. And before we talk about the last couple of years, for our listeners that are not familiar with Spillover, can you tell us about the opening prophetic paragraph of that book?
Wow, I don't know if I remember the opening paragraph of it myself, but essentially I was introducing the subject of zoonotic diseases, diseases that pass from non-human animals into humans, most of those being viral diseases, and the fact that over the last 60 years, there has been an increasing drumbeat of these new diseases, new viruses, highly adaptive, coming out of wildlife and getting into humans by way of human-wildlife contact. And I suppose that I mentioned that we would be hearing more about this in coming years, that zoonotic diseases was not a fringe subject out on the edges of medicine and public health, that it's something central and that people would be forced to become familiar with it in coming years.
And something big was coming. It wasn't coming from outer space. It could be respiratory. It could come from a wet lab, possibly. I think you said Wuhan. It was really, you really nailed it, David.
Well, I'm not Nostradamus. I'm not prophetic. I simply listened to the right scientists, and the scientists knew. The scientists have known this for 20 years, that a pandemic would come, that it would be caused by a virus. In particular, it would be caused by an RNA virus because they are highly changeable and adaptive. And scientists such as Don Burke and Robert Webster and others were telling me back then, 10 years ago more, as I was researching that book, that people should be ready and not be surprised, and that it could well be an influenza or it could well be a coronavirus.
David, I always take such delight in speaking to someone from Bozeman. There's quite a scientific community up there. And I'm happy to say that my mother, who is joining us in the studio this morning, is from the Flathead Valley, Big Fork. So I have a special affinity for for Montana.
There she is. Welcome. Glad to have you as part of this conversation. Yep, Montana it's a chilly early spring day here. We've still got snow in the ground in the shaded areas, and the buds are only beginning. It'll come, but it's taking its time.
Yeah, in Montana, like here in Utah, winter has returned a few times during the month of April, which is a good thing overall for moisture, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to come back to an article that you wrote. It was an op-ed essay in the New York Times from the end of 2020. So it had already begun. When you use the word zoonotic disease.
Zoonotic.
Okay. New word for me. It turned my attention to that op-ed piece in which you were speaking about bats and how they have, yes, infected us and probably did so with the COVID virus, but we have also in turn infected the bat population with what you describe as fungus. Talk a little bit about the interplay between humans and bats.
Well, it's a complicated interplay, and it has become more more acute and has gotten much more attention in recent years as scientists have noticed that many of the new viruses that have come to humans in the last 60 years have their reservoir hosts, which means the animal in which they live over long periods of time inconspicuously without causing trouble in those animals. The reservoir hosts for many of these viruses are bats, different species of bat. So scientific papers have been written on the subject, why bats? Why is it that Marburg virus comes from bats and Hendra virus comes from bats and Nipah virus comes from bats and SARS-1, the original SARS virus, was traced to bats? Why is that? And the scientists have taken pains immediately to say that pattern should not be used to demonize or to further demonize bats. Bats are magnificent creatures. They're wondrous. They're very diverse. They are the second most diverse order of mammals. So there are lots of different kinds of bats living their lives peacefully. But they do, for certain reasons, carry a lot of viruses. And so when humans interfere with bats, when we invade their habitat, when we go into caves where bats roost and harvest guano for fertilizer, or when bats are captured for food, humans get exposed to these viruses. And in some cases, it leads to a spillover of a new virus that can replicate in humans, which sometimes turns into an outbreak of a few dozen cases. And worst case scenario, it turns into an epidemic or a pandemic. I wrote that piece in the New York Times at the request of an editor named Stephanie Geary, who had originally contacted me early in the year to do an op-ed on anything I wanted. She said, for instance, maybe this obscure new virus out of Wuhan, China. This was in January of 2020. And so I ended up doing a number of op-eds for her during that year. And the one about bats, again, it was her idea in particular. Why not write an op-ed? And it turned into something much larger than an op-ed. It turned into essentially a feature article about bats that celebrates them as well as warning about the viruses that they carry. So that was how that particular piece happened.
David, you have written a number of books, including Song of the Dodo, The Tangled Tree, about horizontal gene transfer that we spoke to you about a few years ago, and of course, Spillover, that we're talking a little bit about this morning. You've also researched and written about Ebola. Now, Ebola killed its host before it had a chance to spread to other humans. We may have really dodged a bullet there, but I wanted to ask you, under what circumstances could Ebola have become a pandemic, and how would that change the world, potentially change the world?
Well, John, you're right that Ebola is a very, very lethal disease in humans and also in apes, non-human apes, gorillas and chimpanzees. It kills them at a high rate and as well as killing humans. It abides, as all viruses must abide, in a reservoir host. The animal in which it lives, as I said already, inconspicuously without causing great die-offs of that. And a virus lives in its reservoir host, presumably after thousands of years of mutual accommodation, so that it's essentially a silent infection. So where does Ebola live? Well, we don't know. The reservoir host of Ebola has never been definitively found. You hear people say, well, Ebola also resides in bats, but we don't know that for sure. We don't have the gold standard evidence, which is the isolation of live virus from a sample taken from a bat. Scraps of Ebola virus genome have been found in bats, but that's not the gold standard evidence. So Ebola emerges when some interaction occurs between humans and its reservoir host in Central Africa, whatever that animal is. Might be bats, might be something else. That happened in late 2013, which led to the horrific 2014 Ebola epidemic in those three poor West African countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. And it killed, it infected 27,000 people. It killed about 11,000. That was by far the largest outbreak of Ebola in recorded history, in as long as we've known about Ebola, which goes back to 1976. But it was never really a threat to become a global pandemic, as the scientists knew, because Ebola is just not transmissible enough. It's not as transmissible as respiratory viruses, such as the influenzas and SARS-1 and now SARS-CoV-2. And Ebola spreads in bodily fluids, and as far as we know, only in bodily fluids. Gastrointestinal hemorrhage, diarrhea, vomit, and other bodily fluids carry Ebola, and people get infected when they're in close contact with sick, with Ebola cases, and, you know, cleaning up after them or nursing them or whatever. But it doesn't pass on a cough or a sneeze or a breath or a song, as far as we know. And that's why it has never been as much of a threat to the world as these coronaviruses or the influenzas.
David, prior to COVID, you were always out there in the field talking to scientists. And the last 2 years, you've had your head down. You've been conducting a number of Zoom calls, possibly average 90 minutes each, these interviews with the 94 virologists and other healthcare professionals. I wanted to ask you, of all those interviews, did anything really surprise you?
A lot of things surprised me. I talked to scientists who have, molecular evolutionary virologists who have studied the origins of this virus, studied the pattern of early cases at the Wanan Seafood Wholesale Market in Wuhan. I talked with Tony Fauci. I talked with Barney Graham, who was the principal leader of the development of the Moderna mRNA vaccine at the Vaccine Research Center. Talked to people in China, talked to George Gao, the head of the China CDC. I talked with Dr. Zhengli Shi, the woman at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, who has been studying coronaviruses in bats for 17 years, and who revealed that she and her team had found an earlier coronavirus in bats that was 96% similar to this virus. But what surprised me more than anything was not the revelations that I got from these people, but and not the fact that a lethal, highly dangerous, highly transmissible coronavirus had spilled over into people and turned into a pandemic. What surprised me more than anything was how unprepared we were for this when it went, once it got going. I was in Tasmania researching a different book when this thing really took hold during the month of February. I went down there first days of February. News was out about this. Some people were paying attention to it. The scientists were. Other people were not paying that much attention. I wrote an op-ed for Stephanie Geary before I left that ran in the New York Times January 28th of 2020, saying, hey, folks, this could be it. This could be the one. You should take this thing out of Wuhan very seriously. And because of that, because of my book Spillover, I started getting a lot of calls for interviews while I was in Tasmania. And then on March 2nd, I came back from Tasmania, haven't been on an airplane since then, since March 2nd of 2020, haven't even been out of the state of Montana since then. And I watched and the world watched as we discovered that although scientists had been warning for 20 years about a coronavirus potential pandemic, we were unprepared to deal with it at the level of national leadership, international collaboration, containment, public health measures. That was what surprised me more than anything.
In your case, David, it's kind of not satisfying when you're right about these things, right? You probably would have preferred to be wrong.
I've been asked about that, and I've said, you know, how do you feel about having been right about this, having been quote-unquote prophetic about this? And what I've said is, I'd rather be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I'm curious about, you know, between in these 94 interviews that you have done over the past couple of years, and by the way, one of the things you lament is that you love to write about what you want to write about. But of course, Simon & Schuster, a very reputable publishing house, calls you and says, David, we want you to write a book on the coronavirus. And so I mean, what was behind that decision to go ahead and do it? Because there must have been questions that were left unanswered for you in your previous book, Spillover.
There were, and there was much more to say about this, but and I have a very good relationship with Simon & Schuster. You mentioned The Tangled Tree, which we talked about a few years ago. That was with Simon & Schuster. The publisher and the editor, I get along with very, very well, the CEO, Jonathan Karp, my editor, Bob Bender. I was doing a book for them. I was researching a book for them on cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon, the evolutionary biology of cancer, which is a thing. Cancer is very interesting, as well as horrific phenomenon on the evolutionary biology side. And that's why I was in Tasmania. I came back and they said to me, look, why don't you set that book aside for now and give us a book on this pandemic, on this disease, COVID-19, and I said, and I wrote essentially a proposal on the back of an envelope, and they sent me a contract. And then I had to figure out how to do this. And my usual preference is to write books about things that no one else is writing books about. Horizontal gene transfer. Cancer is an evolutionary phenomenon. Back in 2012, zoonotic diseases. In this case, I knew there was going to be a lot of books about the pandemic. And I had to figure out how to write one that would be uniquely useful and would be different from the others, and how to do it without being able to get on an airplane, as I usually would do, and fly off to places and walk through jungles and climb through caves with the scientists who do the work and tell the story with some an element of adventure as part of the narrative along with the science. So I puzzled over that. How do I write a uniquely useful book if I can't travel and everybody else is going to be writing books about this? And through the year 2020, I sort of ruminated on this and wrote those things for the Times, New York Times, and for some pieces for the New Yorker. And then at the very end of the year, I got the idea that I could do this perhaps by Zoom interviews with the scientists who study the virus. I decided that I would focus on the virus itself, not the public health emergency, not the politics, not the human suffering, as important as all those things were. I would leave that to other people. I would focus on the virus, its origins, evolution, and fierce journey through the human population, and on the scientists who study it. And those scientists as humans, as people, as well as scientists. So I decided I would do extended Zoom interviews with as many of the world's leading virologists and other relevant public health officials as I could, and that I would ask them about the virus and its origins and evolution, but I would also ask them about life for them as teachers, as spouses, as parents, as citizens during the pandemic. So I did all these interviews. It actually ended up being 95 rather than 94. I added one more right at the end. And it was a wonderful experience, all of it by Zoom. I discovered there's a certain intimacy in a Zoom interview. You can talk for an hour and a half with the head of the China CDC by Zoom, and no one knows you're there. His assistant and his assistant's assistant and the security guards have not seen you come in. It's not like, you know, you put on a suit and you pass through security and you finally get to the office of the august Dr. George Gao. You come in by Zoom once he agreed to do this interview, and you find some things in common. And by the end of the conversation, it's David and George having a chat. And I loved that. And it was valuable to me. And that humanity of these people, men and women around the world, is in the book. And I hope that it will help to vivify it for readers.
Excellent. Now, as of the last time I looked at your blog, the title, the anticipated title, is Catching the Virus, the Scientific Race to Decipher and Defeat a Deadly Microbe. Are we sticking with that title, or how many iterations?
I have to update that blog. We went round and round for titles, and we finally settled on one that everybody immediately liked. My wife helped me think of it, brainstorming it here in my little office. The title that the book will be published under is Breathless. Breathless. Subtitle, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. Mm. Breathless. And Jean-Paul Belmondo can haunt me if he sees fit.
Okay. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, thanks for joining us. We're speaking with David Quammen, science writer, number of books, Song of the Dodo, The Tangled Tree, Spillover. Tangled Tree and Spillover, you can go to kpcw.org and get the podcast from those conversations that we had. David, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Long Hauler. We spoke with Tanya Lewis, senior medical editor at Scientific American, recently, and she talked to us about a study that had been conducted with a pretty big sample size that said even those people with mild disease, COVID, appear to be at higher risk of heart problems 1 year after infection. What do we know about long hauler? What do we need to find out about long hauler?
Well, it's not a point that I've researched myself, but what we know about it is that if there is a phenomenon such as long haul COVID, and we clearly see that there is, that should not be surprising, and it's not unique among these devastating viruses. When I was researching spillover, I was talking to people who had been infected with Hendra virus and Nipah virus, and they were experiencing some long haul effects. Even Ebola virus, we have learned, can have long-term effects among those who are lucky enough to survive it, those 40% or 50% who survive an infection of it. Once you're out of the hospital and you've passed the worst of it, does not mean that your body has not been permanently affected by this. So long-haul COVID is something that we will be studying, you know, for years and decades to come, and it will take time, obviously, for the data set to be gathered for us to understand better exactly what it is, let alone how to deal with it. But certainly no one should presume that it's an illusion. It is undoubtedly a real thing. I had dinner with an eminent novelist a few nights ago, Richard Powers, and he told me he's suffering from long haul COVID. I suppose I shouldn't have revealed any medical information about him without his permission, but he was not being particularly cagey about it. I think he has talked about it himself, and so many others. We will be dealing with them and their problems and trying to understand better over a long period of time.
David,
just as we will be dealing with the virus itself in our populations. We will be, I suspect, we'll be vaccinating against this virus for decades to come.
David, for everything that you know about COVID, what one question do you have that has not been answered yet that you would like to have the answer?
Where did this virus come from? That's the question that I would like to see answered. Now, we know to a very, very high degree of probability that it came from a non-human animal, probably through the Wanon Seafood Wholesale Market. There have been some further recent papers published or put up as preprints on that by some of the scientists that I have interviewed repeatedly. There's been speculation, did this come from a lab leak? Was it a manipulated virus? Was it an engineered virus? To my satisfaction, those hypotheses have been falsified. There is enough evidence to say that it is highly, highly, highly unlikely that that is what happened. And it's highly, highly, highly likely that this is a virus that originated in bats or perhaps some animal that received it from bats, an intermediate animal, and that it got to the city of Wuhan that way. But we don't know which. We don't know the absolute details of that. We have found viruses that are 96% similar to this in bats, but we haven't yet found a virus that's 99.5% similar and that we can identify as the progenitor virus. And it's very important for us to do that. And to do that, we need to keep researching. We need to keep sampling animals. We need to keep looking.
David, you just said that the virus will be evolving. We'll be dealing with it for years to come. We'll probably be vaccinating against it for years to come. I think I read these words by you. It's not over and it's no accident. What did that mean?
I can't remember where I might have written those words or spoken them. It's not over is the easy part. Mm-hmm. This virus will never be gotten out of the human population now. We will never eradicate it from the human population. It's too transmissible. It's too widespread. It's too difficult for us to clear the last case. So the pandemic is not over, although the pandemic phase will pass and we'll be dealing with it as spot fires. It's no accident what I meant by that, I assume, is that these viruses come from wild animals, and there are 8 billion of us humans interacting continually with wild animals. So it was only a matter of time that a new one would get into us, and that new one would be a highly adaptable virus, such as a coronavirus or an influenza virus.
I also wanted to mention one more time that if you would like to hear the conversation we had with David about the tangled tree horizontal gene transfer or spillover, 2012 spillover, please go to kpcw.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and it will be there for you. David, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. We look forward to your next book, Breathless, and we look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you very much, John, Lynn. Great to talk with you, and I look forward to that next conversation too.
And
have
a
great day.
We want you out of Montana. We want you to come here and ski with us and maybe have a little bit of fun. What do you think about that?
I love it. Yes. Details to be settled. Yes. TBD.
Sounds good. Thank you,
Excellent.
David.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, too. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with science writer David Quammen, his upcoming book, Breathless. Our next guest is Nicole Junger-Halpern, who we spoke with and taped several weeks ago. Please enjoy this interview. Our next guest is Nicole Junger-Halpern, who has written Quantum Steampunk, the physics of yesterday's tomorrow. Victorian-era steam engines and particle physics may seem worlds as well as centuries apart, yet a new branch of science, quantum thermodynamics, re-envisions the scientific underpinnings of the Industrial Revolution through the lens of today's roaring quantum information revolution. Nicole, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, this is just a whole crazy premise that obviously someone like you, a physicist, Harvard-trained physicist, understands very well. You've been in your own sort of quantum universe. Explain to us first, what is your delivery at a cocktail party when someone says, you know, I just can't grasp what quantum theory is. Can you explain?
Quantum physics is the study of the very small, such as single electrons or atoms or photons, particles of light. These systems can behave in ways that might seem counterintuitive because they're impossible for everyday systems like laptops and microphones and human beings. These are relatively large systems, relatively massive systems, these everyday systems, and we call them classical. The quantum systems can exhibit behaviors like entanglement, which is a very strong relationship that particles can share. And the particles are very strongly correlated. A cartoon picture of what entanglement involves is, suppose that I have an atom and Lynn, you have an atom. We can bring them together and perform some operation on them so that they become entanglement. They come to have this relationship. And then we can take the atoms as far apart as we please. So I can take mine to Maryland. Then if you measure your particle, then sort of in a cartoon picture, my particle changes instantaneously, even though it's very far away. So there's something, some sort of information that's shared within the whole pair of the two particles, not just one, not just in the other, not just the sum of different individual particles. It's in the whole pair.
That's a great explanation. Thank you. Your tagline, the physics of yesterday's tomorrow. And if you look at this whole steampunk genre, it is, I've heard it described before as retro futuristic. So it's exactly what you're saying in your tagline here. So let's go back to the steam engine that really kind of introduced the law of thermodynamics. Talk about your sort of affinity for relooking at the steam engine.
Yes. Steampunk, for listeners who don't know about it, is a genre of science fiction. So it's a genre of literature, art, and film. It features Victorian settings from the 1800s, so also the American Wild Wild West and Meiji Japan. And these old settings have in them futuristic technologies like time machines and dirigibles and automata, some of them powered by steam. As you pointed out, the steam engine was an extremely important driver of the world in the 1800s. The Industrial Revolution was roaring, and thinkers wanted to understand how efficiently engines could power factories and pump water out of mines. So they created the science of energy. The thermodynamics is the study of energy, the different forms that it can have, and the ways that you can transform energy amongst those forms. Thermodynamics was developed to describe the cutting edge technology of the day, which was the steam engine, which consists of many, many particles. It's large, it's massive, so we call it classical. In contrast, today, cutting edge technologies include quantum technologies. We can manipulate single atoms, we can image single atoms, and people are using these counterintuitive behaviors of quantum systems in order to build computers and other information processing devices that can process information in ways impossible for familiar technologies. So we need to re-envision the thermodynamics of the 1800s to make it suitable for the 21st century.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Nicole Younger Halpern, who has written Quantum Steampunk, The Physics of Yesterday's Tomorrow. So with everything that we've learned about quantum, this tremendous body of work over the last 75 years, 80 years, what you're saying is we have to go back to thermodynamics because it may need some updating now that we have learned all of this. Thermodynamics was born in the Industrial Revolution as a result of the steam engine, mostly for the steam engine. And you're saying that we just need to go back and update this and see if there may be any practical advancements that the world can take advantage of from it. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and in fact, when we do update thermodynamics, to describe quantum in small systems, we do get quite an advantage in a few different ways. First, we know that quantum behaviors like entanglement, quantum phenomena like entanglement, can enhance information processing. Quantum computers will be able to solve certain problems much more quickly than even today's supercomputers. So there are information processing tasks like solving computational problems and communicating information and securing information cryptographically. Similarly, there are energy processing tasks like powering cars and charging batteries. Since quantum phenomena can enhance information processing, we can ask, can quantum phenomena also enhance energy processing? And the answer has turned out to be yes. For instance, if you want to charge batteries, then if your batteries are quantum, then you can charge them by a process that creates entanglement or a process that doesn't create entanglement. And if you allow yourself the ability to create entanglement, then you can deliver a higher power to the batteries, so a greater energy per second. And so not only can we imagine new types of technologies using quantum physics, but we can also now say the quantum world is kind of odd. It's different from our normal classical experiences. And how is it different? What makes it different? Part of the way that we answer this question is by saying, well, quantum computers can outperform classical computers on certain tasks. That's one way we understand the difference between the quantum and the classical worlds. Now we can also understand that difference by showing that there are energy processing technologies that can perform better if they're quantum than if they're classical. So we also get a fundamental insight from quantum thermodynamics.
Nicole, I've oftentimes fantasized about going out in the morning and taking my garden hose and topping off my car that is run by hydrogen power. Could this unlock the secrets of hydrogen power?
That would be a great application. The community has not been thinking in that direction. But who knows, maybe it could be a grand challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just fascinating to me. What are some of the things that have surprised you as you've gone through your research and you've collaborated with all these other people around the country that are looking at updating thermodynamics?
It's been astonishing to me that the laws of thermodynamics are still going strong. They started to be codified during the early 1800s, long before even we had the first inklings of quantum theory. And people thought that some of the laws of thermodynamics might be broken by quantum systems. But no, we can actually take the laws of thermodynamics that were originally phrased mathematically for everyday classical systems, and we can translate the thermodynamic laws into the language of quantum theory and show that they still hold. So the laws of thermodynamics turn out to be extremely powerful. Quantum systems do give us ways to sort of bend around the laws of thermodynamics. So you could sort of imagine an engine that you might think is supposed to obey the laws of thermodynamics, but you slip in some quantum resource, kind of like entanglement, and the engine no longer satisfies the assumptions under which the laws of quantum, the thermodynamic laws are supposed to hold. So you can quote unquote violate the laws of thermodynamics, but not really.
Wow. So maybe you could take this into a practical application for our listeners. So back in maybe it was 2016, we bought a little electric car, a Nissan Leaf, and I think its range was like 90 miles, and it was you know, is great, but 90 miles is not very far, and even less so when it's cold and you're going up mountains like we have here in Park City. And then, you know, fast forward to right now, I think you're getting, you know, some of the Teslas are getting beyond 300 miles as a range. So when we look at quantum versus classical, you know, where are we on that spectrum of, you know, when it comes to something like battery technology? And then let's talk a little bit about engines as well.
Yes. Quantum thermodynamicists have identified a number of energy processing technologies such as batteries and engines and refrigerators, such that according to certain metrics, the quantum version can outperform the classical version. Also, some experiments have been performed to realize, for instance, quantum engines. But the quantum thermodynamic technologies that have been realized so far are not practical. They're not at that level. The experiments have been first principle. This is an important step. We've shown that you can realize quantum engines, but to tell the truth, you have to cool down systems to make them exhibit quantum behaviors, and that cooling requires work. It requires energy. Once you've cooled down the system so that it can behave as a quantum engine, then you get out a little bit of work, but it is a very small amount of work because the engine is quantum. So what's been realized so far hasn't been practical, but the community is right now pivoting toward asking, how can we make quantum thermodynamics practical? So I'm working with some experimentalists at Chalmers University in Sweden with Simona Gasparnetti's group. And we're working on a quantum refrigerator that will service quantum computers. And according to our simulations of the experiment, which probably won't be matched exactly by the experiment, but we can hope the experiment does well enough. According to these simulations, the refrigerator, if it works properly, actually will be competitive with some of the best technologies that we know, and so could actually be useful, for instance, in servicing quantum computers.
Okay, so the idea is cooling things down. We have a quantum refrigerator, and there is some technological promise in cooling down these quantum computers. And then how does that sort of translate into a more practical application, you know, that we might see in our kitchen?
I don't know to what extent quantum thermodynamics will end up in our kitchens. At the moment, we're pretty far away from that stage. But cooling down systems for the sake of quantum computers is actually very useful because quantum computers quantum systems generally are very difficult to control. And so if you're building a quantum computer, then you'll tend to have a whole lot of control cables and expend a lot of energy on it. And so having a convenient quantum method of cooling down your system is actually quite useful. When I say I don't know if quantum thermodynamic technologies will ever make it into our kitchens, then I sort of have the perspective of people from a number of decades ago who said, oh, people are building desktop computers, but probably no one's ever going to have them in their homes, right? So I can't really tell what's going to happen, whether we will end up someday with quantum thermodynamic technologies in our homes.
Nicole, you are a very curious person. You ask a lot of questions. What one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet?
One of the questions that has been interesting me most now is how widespread can quantum thermodynamic technologies become? We've learned a great deal foundationally about the nature of our universe from our studies of quantum thermodynamics. And as I said, now is when the community is pivoting toward trying to find applications. So I think that that's one of the most exciting frontiers for this field.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, quantum is a small and very close together. Relativity is the large and very far apart. They both make sense, but they don't exist together unless you've got, or we can't reconcile it unless we have something called string theory that sort of brings the two and allows them to exist. Does string theory still hold up?
Right. So as a little bit more background for some listeners. There's been over the decades, a grand challenge of trying to build a theory of quantum gravity that will describe, for instance, the beginning of the universe and black holes. There are a number of different approaches to try to establish a theory of quantum gravity. One popular approach is string theory. Some alternatives include loop quantum gravity. I think that it's wonderful that people are taking on this challenge. I don't myself belong to that community, so I don't actually have a favorite candidate, but a lot of work is happening in those communities, and quantum information has actually contributed to the study of string theory and the black hole information paradox. So string theory is definitely has a community that is vibrant and active and is incorporating tools from quantum computing.
Lynn, before you ask your next question, I just wanted to say that I think Nicole would be a ton of fun at one of our cocktail parties.
I think I would have fun at your cocktail parties.
Oh, Nicole, we would. We would. We absolutely would.
So, Nicole, I just have to ask you, if you look up, if you Google quantum steampunk, one of the things that comes up is steampunk quantum computer. And I'm wondering if it's just a play on this kind of genre of, like you say, art and culture and, where does that come from? You can't really have a steampunk in my idea computer, but where might that come from?
That's interesting. I need to look up quantum steampunk or quantum computer steampunk. steampunk quantum computer, that's what you said. I need to look that up on Google. I actually haven't done that, so I haven't found that page. My guess would be that someone has taken inspiration from quantum physics and maybe made a piece of art or elaborated on an idea for a story. Quantum computers are being built today. We do have some small-scale quantum computers. A lot of work needs to be done to build them up into the large scale where they need to be to solve really hard problems as quickly as we hope. And thermodynamic effects are certainly relevant to quantum computers. As I mentioned before, quantum systems need to be cooled down to low temperatures, and the expulsion of heat is a thermodynamic process. So personally, I think of the setting of quantum computers as inherently a quantum steampunk one.
I love it. And speaking of art and steampunk, your background, I'd call that pretty steampunk.
Thank you.
It's really great. Too bad our listeners can't see it, but what is that?
Yeah, I was contacted by a steampunk artist a couple of years ago. His name is Bruce. He has a workshop in Massachusetts, and he creates a large kinetic interactive steampunk sculptures. He saw a talk of mine and said, we should collaborate on a quantum steampunk sculpture. So we designed a large kinetic interactive sculpture that would have a little trapped ion quantum engine in the center, and then the classical version of the engine on the outside. And
wow.
Of course, for anything to become reality, you need an input of funding. So that's what we're looking for now, to try to turn this drawing into reality.
Oh, I love it. That is great. I'm glad I asked. Well, the book is Quantum Steampunk, The Physics of Yesterday's Tomorrow. Our guest, Nicole Younger Halpern. And Nicole, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. I want to remind everybody that there is an accident on I-80 westbound, and it's backed up from 215 all the way to the quarry. And just took a peek at some cameras on UDOT, and it looks like they're taking people off of Interstate 80 on the westbound side. I think they're probably putting them on 215. It's hard to tell from here, but it's backed up all the way to the quarry. So if you do not have any rush to get to Salt Lake City and you're hearing this report, you may want to may want to take some time before you make that trip down to Salt Lake City. Well, let's see here. I want to first thank our wonderful guest this morning. Our first guest was David Quammen, author of 2012 book Spillover, that predicted in uncanny detail the 2019 COVID pandemic. He's been working the last couple of years on a new book on COVID. And then we want to thank Nicole Younger-Halpern, who has written Quantum Steampunk, The Physics of Yesterday's Tomorrow. And what she does is she re-envisions a steam engine and the laws of thermodynamics from the Industrial Revolution through the lens of today's quantum information. And we want to thank you for joining Cool Science Radio. If you have any show ideas, give us, send us an email at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you want to share it, all our shows are under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcast, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.